I know that some of you, probably a good many of you, will remember the days of TVs being those big units that rather dominated the room. And rare was the house that had more than one, at least in my childhood and in my neighborhood. You typically find this increasingly large piece of furniture in the living room, or if you were so blessed, in what was referred to as the rumpus room, a term that seems to have been replaced by family room or playroom, but I still like the sound of rumpus room. Anyway, somewhere in the early days of TV culture, we were treated to the arrival of another curious piece of furniture, the TV tray. That may still be a thing for all I know, but in my experience, they were largely a feature of my growing up years. These little personal tables, not always the most stable piece of furniture in the room, but they permitted you to eat a meal while sitting in front of the TV. This was well before anyone considered it to be even vaguely conceivable that you could have a TV in the kitchen. Madness, they just took up far too much room. In my family, we did have TV trays, but we only got to use them now and then. The TV tray experience was very much considered a treat in my family back in the now distant geological age of the 1950s and 60s. They were reserved for royal weddings, the occasional TV special on our one channel, significant breaking news, and of course, playoff hockey. My parents were of the mind that families should eat together regularly, and we were required to practice that whether Phil liked it or not. The family meal was not to be interrupted by technology, but it was a time when we were to eat and communicate, yes, the word from which we get our word, communion. Supper time would see the four of us, Peg, Gord, John, and Phil. Lovely little Phil. Memory plays tricks on you once you reach my age. Anyway, we'd be sitting at the dining room table and there would be some family rituals that we would have to follow. Though we didn't name those behaviors quite that way at that time. No, they were just the way we did things. Habits that we developed. You know, who served, the use of napkins, the way the cutlery was laid out. The things that you talked about, and Phil, the things you don't talk about at dinner. But interaction was an expectation. And lively interaction was definitely encouraged in the Spencer household as our days were each reviewed. As I look back on it, I know there was something life-giving in that regular part of my day. When I left home, I was, of course, on my own for a while, and so I often ate alone, and yes, I would even watch TV as I ate, because it was company. See, I realized that companionship was, and remains to this day, an important part of a meal for me. When I met Tevis and we got married, that old habit was still there. She'd come from a family that had similar practices, and so we'd eat together. And when our kids arrived, we developed our own ritual behavior, our way of doing things. And it's certainly not necessarily the right way of doing things, but they did become our way of doing things. No TV permitted. Though playoff hockey might sometimes be allowed, there was some mellowing of that rule sometimes. We always set the table. For some reason, we typically used and continue to use cloth napkins, except when we entertain, when we haul out paper napkins, which is backwards, but anyway. And we would talk. We would unpack our days and try and make sense of what we were all experiencing. And I have a hunch that our dinner table was one of the key teaching instruments, often unknowingly for all of us, but it was one of the key teaching tools for our kids growing up, through which, for better or for worse, standards were set and norms and expectations of behavior were established. And dinner with friends as well as family. Oh, that's always been wonderful. It's just really hard to beat. there are the occasions, you know, like Christmas and Easter and Thanksgiving and birthdays and anniversaries. And then there are those other planned dinner parties that are simply about enjoying time together. And then again, there are those spontaneous events that just suddenly arrive. And there you all are, just eating together. And one of my fondest memories is how when our kids were little, our good friends Maria and Kip would arrive at our door with their two little girls in tow, and they'd say, "So what are you guys having for dinner now?" And sometimes, and this is true, still clad in pajamas, they would say, "What are you having for breakfast now?" And the meal was on. But you know, aside from the food, what made it wonderful was all the other stuff. Conversation and the telling of stories and lots of laughter at our table typically. And just being together in community, in communion. I am blessed with a spouse who's a fine cook and a good host. I'm not sure, is it hostess still? I kind of lost that the track on that one when we lost actress to actor and they all moved into one. Anyway, I think she's a host these days. And she's a really good one. She adds all sorts of touches to the meal. And she's a great, great believer in always an extra seat available. That rule. Should someone arrive unannounced. And particularly if we're graced with the presence of someone we might not know yet. And yes, even if that requires the quiet FHB, family hold back. That instruction sometimes given before serving if we don't have quite enough. Like many of you, we enjoy being able to share the table with family and friends, and yes, with strangers. In fact, I find dinner in some way blurs that distinction between friends and family and strangers. There's a particular closeness in sharing a meal, in bringing people together around a table. For to eat with others is a powerful thing. It's an intimate thing. Tonight we're reflecting on the events of the night before Jesus was crucified. In John's Gospel we're told that this is actually the night before the Passover festival. John wants us to make the connection between what happens to Jesus on the cross and that dramatic story of God's intervention and the liberation of the Hebrew slaves that was so critical to Israel's self-understanding. The Passover, a spring festival that centers on how the slaves in Egypt were told to avoid the last and most deadly of the 10 plagues, the death of the firstborn sons. They were to dab the doorposts of their houses with the blood of a slaughtered lamb. And when God saw the blood, God would pass over their homes and they would be saved. And yes, some of the flesh of that lamb would be eaten by the family. In John's Gospel, it's always wise to read in light of what he records in the introductory chapter. And yes, right at the beginning of his Gospel, he notes Jesus' herald, John the Baptist, on two occasions, declaring Jesus to be the Lamb of God. I think John's drawing our attention to this connection right from the beginning. Jesus and his friends, they're having supper, and I wonder what the mood in the room was. Was it excitement, anxiety, uncertainty, doubt, fear, hope, or some combination of all those things? Suddenly, Jesus arises from the table, and he removes his outer robe, and he prepares himself for some work. He pours some water in the basin, and he proceeds to go around the room, and he starts washing the disciples' feet. And they were shocked, taken aback, scandalized by this behavior. For this is the lesser job. It's one done by someone lower in social rank, certainly not the master. And yet that's what Jesus did. Peter, it's often Peter who's our stand-in, I find. He refuses until Jesus says that, well, this is one of the terms of the relationship. And if he, their teacher, is going to serve them, then it's incumbent upon his disciples to serve one another. Aside from your kids,
Have you ever washed anyone?
When I was an RN, I was required to do that now and then. Of course, when I was in the operating room, it was actually pretty straightforward because people were, if not unconscious, certainly quite groggy. And so there was little emotional cost to this on either side. It was just business, and my patients probably never knew what I or what we'd together done. It was a little different when I was in the emergency room. People were usually awake, sometimes very awake, upset, even combative. But they were quite aware, typically. And what I was conscious of, and I'm sure they were too, was how intimate an act this is. Even just washing someone's hands or feet to clean them for a procedure of some sort, you get really close. Hence you develop practices and manners and an etiquette. You had to know when to look someone in the face and when not to look them in the face. And I had to learn how to manage that intimacy for the both of us. So I can see how the disciples were just a little freaked out when Jesus did what he did. And later on in our reading, Jesus says something that spells out the principle that I believe undergirds this whole scene. In John chapter 13, verse 34, he says, "I give you a new commandment." And that word commandment in Latin is mandatum. Hence we have mandatum or Maundy Thursday. "I give you a new mandatum, a new commandment, that you love one another. Just as I loved you, you also should love one another." Seems that Jesus wants us to know that there's a link between loving and serving, and they are not optional. They are expectations of his people. Close relationships are a part of who we are as disciples. It goes with the territory. John tells us that they had supper. He doesn't actually tell us what happened at supper, but maybe he didn't need to. He knew he didn't need to. When the other three gospel writers get to telling the story, they all say pretty much the same thing, which is essentially what we heard Paul share in his letter to the church in Corinth, perhaps 10 or 15 years before the first gospels were ever recorded, was the time of that writing. I have a hunch that Paul knew those words really, really well. It was likely all new Christians were required to learn them. These words that Jesus used at what we now call the Last Supper. How the Lord had taken bread, given thanks, broken it, given it to be consumed, connected the bread to his body, and then made a similar link between the cup and his blood. And when you receive the bread and the cup, you're to remember Jesus. In the technical language of the church, we call these words the words of institution today. And they're regularly found, not always word for word, but they're there in some manner within our communion services. There's some scholarly debate about as to whether they were even said at communion in those early days of the church, but there's absolutely no doubt that all church members would have learned them because this is the central rite of the gathered Christian community. Coming together for a meal to remember Christ and let me quote Paul directly here, to proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. The Lord's death. Interesting, he'd choose that, eh? The Lord's death. Paul is saying, never forget the centrality of what happened on Good Friday. We must never, ever avoid the importance of the cross, which just as John sets the theological table at the beginning of his gospel, Paul does in his letter to the Corinthians, saying in the first chapter that the cross was foolishness to some and a scandal to others, but to the faithful, it's the very power of God. What we will remember together here tomorrow is central to our faith. I always aim to be honest with you, but I'm quite prepared to admit that there are some things I probably don't talk about that much because I'm a bit unsure. There are some subjects I'm pretty confident about, and I will happily return to them week after week, and I'm sorry about that, but I like them. But then there are some other things that remain elusive to me, that are mysterious, It's like I only catch a glimpse of them. What happens on the communion table for me is one of those mysterious things. And probably the greatest confidence that I have about the communion table is that there's a lot more going on there than I know. When we gather together around the table, when we come forward to receive the elements, I know there is a lot of different things going on amongst us, in part because I realize it's for me a shifting experience as well. The one constant is that the Lord's table is always a place of intimacy, of vulnerability to me. I'm aware of a need. I'm aware of my dependence. I'm aware of our interdependence when I go to the table. Whether I'm standing behind or waiting with hands extended before the table, I am always aware of whose table it really is. Always a little in awe that I get invited to this meal. That even I get invited. There's always a chair there for me. There's some days when it's pure joy, when it's a glorious anticipation of the wedding feast of the Lamb, a hint of the messianic banquet that will take place, and I wonder, perhaps it's already begun somehow. When the faithful will sit at the table and we'll see our Lord Jesus at the head and we'll finally see him, he'll be presiding, he'll be host of the ultimate family dinner. And what a day, what a party that is going to be. And other days, frankly, coming to the table, it's about discipline. It's about coming to the table even though my heart's much less than healthy. It's about allowing God in when I'm inclined to do otherwise. Maybe all I can do is eat the bread and drink the juice. But somehow God's getting in. Sometimes, more times than I like to admit, but I come here knowing that I am the last person who deserves to be here. Such is the state of my soul. Such is my need for forgiveness. But I'm drawn here, for forgiveness is present in the bread and the cup. Did you know that John Wesley, no less, he actually argued that for some, conversion actually begins at the communion table. It can be a place where God draws people even before baptism, even before consciously choosing to follow Christ, and that the stranger may begin to gloriously lose that status at the communion table. It can mark an important moment in our trip home after having been to a distant land squandering our inheritance, or having been pouting outside the welcome home party for that matter. There's a lot going on here. Much, much more than I know. Let me close with just a couple of thoughts. First is that even though communion has its etiquette, and these manners vary from place to place, at the end of the day, it's a kind of a family meal. And at Jesus' table, it is, after all, his table, there's always an extra seat. And the family never needs to hold back because there's always enough. And yes, there is a special intimacy when the family gathers around his table. And you know it shows. I always find it moving to see people coming forward to receive. And I know Diane does too. We've talked about it. If and when you are asked to serve communion here, I urge you to please say yes. Please say yes. You'll see a whole range of new things. You'll see expressions vary, and it's apparent that people are coming from different places and with different expectations and different understandings. And while we do not encourage this, nor do we discourage it, because for the moment, I think it's okay. For the moment. But occasionally, I'll see people exchange a touch as they come forward. Or they'll exchange a look, a glance. And it's clear that the table does remind us of Jesus' commandment that we're to remember tonight, that we're to love one another. And my final rambling thought is this. Wherever you are in your spiritual walk this evening, as you come forward, as the bread and the wine are offered to you, don't forget to remember. Pay attention to the words that are on the front of our communion table. Even though we might not fully understand the mysteries of this celebration, let's take a moment to remember Jesus, to do as he asked his friends, to simply remember him. Remember the one whose love for us will be so powerfully demonstrated in his faithfulness tomorrow. Amen.